sure good to see each and every one that's able to be out this evening, and I want you to know that I appreciate your concern for spiritual matters. It's a Saturday night and a lot of other things you could be doing, and you've chosen to be here, and that means a lot. Not that you came to hear me, but that you came together that we might collectively worship. Brian kind of set the tone for this evening, because regardless of what I may have told Bob in the past, if you want to hear the lesson on the four branches, you're going to have to come back in the morning. Because tonight I'm going to preach a different lesson. I'm going to preach about the jury tonight. And like I said, I probably told Bob the four branches, but tonight we're going to talk about a lesson called the jury. The defense attorney was in a very, very tight spot. He was defending a client of the charge of murder. And all the evidence seemed to point to his client. And the only weakness in the prosecutor's case was that the body hadn't been found. But everything else, you know, points to his client. And so it's time to sum up and to make the closing arguments. And he, as the defense attorney often does, they get right in front of the jury, or he gets in front of the jury, and says, "You see that clock there on the wall?" And it had one of the big clocks with those big second hands, you know, that ticked down. And he said, and he looked at his watch, and he's paying it for all he can. He looked at his watch, he said, "In exactly 2 minutes," said, "the man that's presumed dead is going to walk through those two doors in the back of the courtroom." And he didn't say a word. He just stopped. And he looked, and everybody's looking at the clock, looking at the doors, looking at the clock, looking at the doors, looking at the clock, looking at the doors. 2 minutes passed by, the doors don't open. And so the defense attorney says, "I've noticed by watching you on the jury that every one of you looked at the clock and every one of you looked at the doors. And so there has to be some doubt in your mind as to whether my client actually killed anybody or not, or you wouldn't have been watching." And so the jury goes out, and 15 minutes later, they come back in, and the judge always does, he says, "Foreman of jury, have you reached a verdict?" And he says, "We have, Your Honor. We find the defendant guilty." And so the trial is over. Well, later, the defense attorney gets the foreman of the jury off to the side, and he asks him about the decision. And he said, "You know, I noticed that every one of y'all was looking at that clock, and every one of you were looking at the doors. Everybody in the courtroom was looking. You know, surely there was a little doubt in your mind." And the foreman of the jury said, "You're right. Said everybody on the jury looked at that clock, looked at the doors. Said I looked around the courtroom, everybody was watching the clock and watching the doors, except one person. Said your client never looked at the clock. Your client never looked at the doors." And that convinced us that he knew the man wasn't coming in the doors. And that's what it convinced him to convict him. And the whole point of this little story about a jury, or the jury, is that people watch. And people watch very closely at what you do and how you behave. And that's what I want to think about this evening. We're going to ask four little questions, and then the lesson will be yours. But first thing I want to think about, and I'll try to maybe walk back and forth a little bit and let you see the screen at least for a moment, but when the world looks at you, what do they see? And, you know, that's part of human nature. It's observing human behavior and looking at people round about them. But hopefully, when the world looks at us, they see a difference. They see someone who is not like most of the people that they are acquainted with. And if that's the case, then that's what God expects. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 14, he said, "Who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from all iniquity, and purify unto himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works." Now, you look to this idea of peculiar. It's not only Paul that uses this particular phrase, at least in the King James Version, but Peter said the same thing. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, he says, "If you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praise of him who has called you out of darkness unto his marvelous light." Now, the example that I'm going to use might mean more to some than it would to others, but what do we think of when we think about peculiar? Well, something's just not quite right. Something's just a little bit off or a little bit strange. That's how most people think of the word peculiar. Well, one time Andy Taylor was talking to his boy Opie, and he asked him, did he know what peculiar meant? And he said, "Yeah, Daddy." He said, "I know what peculiar means. It means dirty." And he said, "Well, why did you think that?" He said, "Well, I got to school today, and the teacher was walking around, and she looked at me, and she asked me if I took a bath and washed real good, and I told her I had. And she said, she looked at my neck, and she said, well, that's peculiar. And so that's the reason I know it means dirty." He said, "Because Daddy said I didn't wash my neck, and it was dirty." But so he kind of misunderstood the way the word meant. But in the Bible, it means special. And you look at the New King James Version, and that's what it says, a holy nation, his own special people. And you know, that's what God has always expected. That's what God has always wanted. When He chose the children of Israel, you look back in Exodus chapter 19, right before the law was given there on Mount Sinai, and it says in Exodus 19, verse 5, "Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then shall you be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine." And you know, you can just almost see this in the book of Titus, in the verse in Titus back then, but maybe not except for the part of the cleansing by the blood of Jesus. But the whole idea is that God has always wanted somebody special to serve Him. And that's what we've got to be. You look in 1 Peter chapter 3, and you see a good example of people observing other people. I always like this verse that you can imagine a man that wasn't really interested in what the old stuffy preacher had to say. He always preaches too long, and he just bores me to death. And so he's one of those that he doesn't get much out of the lesson. But here it says, "Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation, or the lifestyle and the life of the wife, when they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear." And so even though this man, in the example, is not impressed with what the preacher has to say, he keeps watching his wife. He sees her sincerity. He sees that she puts God first, that she puts the Lord first, above all things, above her family, even above him, that she is going to serve the Lord. And maybe it causes him to think. And because of him watching her example, then eventually he may be converted and become a Christian. Let me tell you, this happens. A lot of stories, you know, that can be told, but I'll tell you one very quickly. A young lady that goes to church at Needmore, and I used to teach teenage class on Wednesday night, and I taught her for the time she was just barely was a teenager until we, you know, she got married. But she began to date this young man in the small town that they lived in, and he was a member of the denomination. He was Baptist, and his parents very strong in the church. And Kara told him right off the bat, "Now, if we're going to go out," said, "you're going to have to come to church with me." That "I'm not going to do this alternating, and you know, I go with you one Wednesday night and you go with me the next Wednesday night or every other Sunday." Said, "If we're going to date, then you come to church with me." And Todd came to church with her all the time that they were dating, and then for several years even after they were married, and then Todd obeyed the gospel. And you know, he said, "I should have done this a long time ago." And I said, "Well, maybe so, but you've done it now, and that's what's important." But Kara was very firm and very, you know, kind. But she just said, "You know, my faith is the most important thing to me, and that's something I want to share with you." And she stuck to her guns. And you know, it's a wonderful thing when somebody, just because of somebody's example, can lead somebody else to Christ. And that's not an excuse not to try to teach somebody, because opening the Bible and being able to read to them about Jesus and tell the wonderful story is desperately needed. But we need to also realize that people watch the lifestyle that we're living. We all know this little verse here: "To give the light of the world, the city that is set on a hill cannot be hid." I don't care if we think much about the lights until the power goes off and you flip the switch and there's nothing that happens. But back then, you know, lights were oftentimes even a way of communication. In the city of Lachish, or in the ruins of Lachish, they have discovered what has been dubbed the Lachish letters. And in one of those letters, it talks about how that they are watching for the fire, the signal fire. You know, this was toward the end of the book of Jeremiah, and things are really, you know, happening bad. And so the only way they could signal that they were under attack is that the enemy was coming to the lightest beacon, you know, so that it could be seen. And that's the way it is. Somewhere a lot, you know, a city on top of a hill, especially with a light burning, it can't be hit. And so they're watching for it. And in fact, I think it's Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 1. It talks about the signal fires and something that they would have been well acquainted with. And Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 7 says, 1,000 shall flee at the rebuke of one, and at the rebuke of five shall ye flee, till ye be left as a beacon upon the top of a mountain, and as an infant on a hill. And, you know, it's really interesting too, you know, how far and how bright a light seems, especially in the darkness. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16, we all know, and we even sing about, you know, letting our light shine with this little light of mine. But he said, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." And as I look at this audience, I know that you understand these verses, but you know, it's a good idea to think about, you know, what they mean, even though you may already be well established in them, as Peter said in 2 Peter. But you think about this light shining. What is it shining upon? You know, the light, we don't shine the light upon ourselves. The light is not a spotlight that he's talking about here. I always love to go outside maybe on a clear winter night, and I live out in the country, and so there's not a lot of light around it, but to look at the moon. And sometimes we think, boy, the moon sure was bright last night, wasn't it? And when you look at it from a purely technical point of view, we know that the moon necessarily isn't bright or dark. But when the earth is here and the sun is here and the moon is behind on this side, then the sun is reflecting upon the moon, even though it may be night for us. And we're turned away from the sun. And so we see the reflection of the sun so very brightly. And then when the moon's on this side of the earth, and, then the sun doesn't reflect on the side of the moon we see. So, we can't see the moon hardly at all. It might be just a trace of the outline or something. But the whole idea is the moon shines so brightly, as we call it, but the moon has no light of its own. All it does is reflect the light of the sun. And that's the way our lives are to be. The light that we shine before men is a reflection of the sun. And then when they see that, they recognize that, and they glorify the Father, which is in heaven. There's a wonderful example of this in the book of Daniel, in chapter 6, when the decree has been passed that nobody can pray to anybody but the king. And Daniel, as it was his custom and his habit, he goes back and he opens his window toward Jerusalem and he continues to pray just like he always has. And they run and squeal on him. That was the intention right off the bat. And the law can't be changed. And so Daniel is going to be cast into a den of lions. And the king just hated it because he really loved Daniel and he recognized it. He'd been tricked into making such a proclamation to begin with. But they get there to the edge of the pit. And I always thought, again, so amazing that it wasn't Daniel looking at the king and seeing the distress that he's in. He said, listen, don't worry. He said, I serve a God that can protect me. Don't worry about me. But you remember what was said? It said, the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake, and he says to Daniel, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver you. Not Daniel, he'll deliver me, but no, Daniel, he's going to deliver you. How did he know about Daniel's God? Well, he had observed Daniel, and Daniel's light had shined brightly, not upon himself, but to show what God could do. Look at Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15. That you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation among whom you shine as lights in the world. And, that last part, whom you shine as lights in the world. And the darker and the more evil our world becomes and our nation gets and the nations round about us grow, the lighter, the brighter our light is going to shine. And so we should never be ashamed to be the type of people that when people look at us, they see something different. Now, they may see someone that they do not understand. Or they may see somebody that does things that they don't understand. And, that's okay, because God has made provision for this also. Remember 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. But sanctify the Lord God in your heart, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks if you a reason of the hope that is in you, with meekness and in fear. Not in haughtiness, meekness and in reverence. But, this is not to say that we're going to know how to answer every single question when it comes to evolution, and we know about the foreknowledge of God, and questions maybe that people want to know about the book of Revelation. We might not be able to answer every single question like that. But he says that we need to be able to give an answer for that ask you about the reason of the hope that is within you. And you remember last night we talked about confidence, or the hope that we have, and that hope is heaven. Why do we believe that we're going to go to heaven? Well, because God so loved the world that he would send his son to this earth, that Jesus would willingly die on the cross. When Peter tried to defend him with a sword, the Lord said, well, don't worry, put your sword up, Peter. If I needed to, said I could call, thousands of angels to defend me, but I came to this earth to die. I laid my life down, he told him, and I picked it up and raised it up again. And so, we have a lot of reasons that we can give to people that ask us the hope that is within us. And we need to be not only able to, but willing to do it. Now let's tell you something else that we begin to see more and more, again, in the time that we live, is that when people look at us and they see the type of life that we're trying to live, they may see somebody that irritates them. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, from the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lasciviousness and lust and excess of wines and reveling and banquetings and abominable idolatry. And then he says in verse 4, wherein they think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of life, speaking evil of you. Because we no longer do this. We're Christians. I can't live like that anymore. I don't want to live like that anymore. And so the life that you're trying to live, see, exposes the error in their life. And so, okay, you're saying, that you're better than me now. That, what I'm doing is not right. And, a lot of times people get upset and irritable about things like this. Well, sometimes that's the consequence of being Christian. Peter also said, for what glory is it if when you are busted for your faults, you take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. And we know all the circumstances about Peter and everything, but he mentioned several times this concept of suffering for what you believe in. Yet if any man suffers a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. And then again in verse 19, wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well doing as unto a faithful Creator. And there's more we could say about what those out there in the world see when they look at us. But we'll move on and we'll ask the next question. What do your brethren see? When we look at one another. Now, of course, we always look for the best in one another, but do they see somebody they can depend upon, especially when times are hard and the chips are down? I'm sure every congregation probably has one or maybe a plurality of them, but I know up at where I attend, it needs more. I'm actually only there one Sunday morning. I'm there the fourth Sunday of the month, and maybe a fifth Sunday if I don't go off somewhere. But first Sunday, second Sunday, and third Sunday, I'm not there. And so it may be that we set up a gospel meeting, and sometimes it's people I know, and I will call and, you know, arrange the times and everything with it. And I'll tell them, now, when you get to the building, if you need anything, if you need help with getting the computer to work, if you need this or that, you need to see this person, or you need to see this other person. One of them, that Todd, that I was just telling you about, that obeyed the gospel. If you need anything at all, another one, I'm not ashamed to say, it's my brother. I said, you see my brother Keith, and anything you need, he'll take care of it for you. And it's whatever, or Todd, and Todd will take care of anything you need. You know, is that what our brethren see in us? The Bible talks about the manifold wisdom of God, and certainly it's seen in the world that we live in, but it says in Ephesians 3 and verse 10, the intent that to the principalities and powers in heavenly places might be known by the church, the manifold wisdom of God. And I think one of the ways the wisdom of God is demonstrated is in the fact that there is a church to begin with. That people, as we oftentimes say, of life, strength, and faith meet together and become a family and begin to depend upon each other and to lean upon each other. There's so many passages that we can look at. And it's like in Romans chapter 12 and verse 15, it says, rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. And while we may do that with those out in the world, with family members and things like this, that's something as brethren that we share. And what a blessing it is. That's a passage that I think we don't oftentimes get the full import of. And that's Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. It says, brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, that thou also be tempted. And generally it seems like that, well, here's how we look at this. We have a business meeting. And it finally rolls around, well, what about old Joe? You know, he's quit coming to church. Somebody's got to go talk to him. Well, I went last time, you know, and talked to him. And, well, I'm not very good at this. And we go around the table, you know, trying to find somebody that's going to be willing to, you know, have to go talk to him. And it's not always a pleasant thing, but you know, that's not the way that we ought to look at this. Not that it doesn't need to be done, but this is his brethren. And this is one of you. If he's caught up in something, we need to go to him, because next time it may be us. And I'm reminded of a story in the Old Testament when the children of Israel were going to go fight against the Ammonites. And the Ammonites had plenty of time to know that they were coming. So they go and hire an army of the Syrians. And so when they get there, they look and and I'm trying to think if the number, if they were outnumbered or not. But anyway, they were fighting a big, big host. Joab, remember, is the leader of the army under David's reign, you might say. He had a brother named Abishai. And so Joab, he picks his army, the ones that he's leading. He says, I'm going to put my troops there up against these hired soldiers, the Syrians. Abishai, you take your troops and you fight against the Ammonites. And then you know what he said? Now, if the Syrians are too strong for me, brother, you come help me. He said, but I'll be watching, and if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I'm going to come help you. And so even though they were both fighting their particular group and their enemies, they were both looking over their shoulder at one another because they were brothers. And they would be willing to leave and come help them in their battle. And you know, that's the way we need to see it as Christians when we're looking at one another. You know, if we see somebody that's overtaken in fault, that's my brother. I've got to go talk to him. You know, his soul is in danger, and he's going to be watching for me. And so, you know, we can't be ashamed to look for one another and to ask, is everything okay? You know, sometimes people are reluctant or hesitant to say that I'm having problems. a young man at Needmore this Wednesday night. He said, "Listen, when you make the closing announcements and lead the closing prayer, will you pray for me? Because I'm having some problems at home." He didn't go into any detail. "And will you ask everybody here to pray for me?" And I said, "Well, sure we will." And so, you know, we publicly prayed for him, and then individually, I hope everybody's praying for him. But not everybody's willing to do that. And sometimes it's financial matters. You know, if a local, you know, somebody in a local congregation is having, you know, a real unexpected difficulties, you know, there's nothing wrong with mentioning that to your brothers. And I know we're not here just to be a, you know, ATM giving out money. But when we have problems, we're there for one another. There's a verse here in Proverbs chapter 27, verse 5 and 6 that it really hits home. It says, "Open rebuke is better than secret love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." I'll tell you who the best friend that you have on this earth. It's a man that will point out, you know, that there's something amiss in your life. Or the woman that will come to you and say, "What's this? You know, is there any truth to this? This is what people are starting to say. I hope there's not. Is there any truth to that?" But we'll call it to your attention and point it out to you. Open rebuke is, if they're going to say, "Well, I love them," I couldn't say anything to them. They know what they're doing and all that. No. Again, faithful are the wounds of a friend and the kisses of an enemy. It's not always easy, but that's what people do that love one another. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 6, it says, "But Christ, the Son, over his own house." And look at that next little phrase. Whose house are we if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end? But we're a part of that house, and we're a part of it together. When brethren look at you, when we look at one another, do we see a worker? This is one of my favorite passages, and I guess I say that a lot. It seems like my favorite passage is the one I'm talking about at the time. But 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, he says, after discussing the concept of the resurrection, and we're going to talk about this on Sunday also, but he said, "Therefore, based on all we've talked about, you know, that there is going to be a resurrection. My beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Do people see somebody that can find the time, that can make the time? And I know life is hectic, and it seems like it gets worse. You know, the older you get, and talking about being naive, I always thought when you're younger that when you got older, you know, you had less to do and more time to do it. But in reality, you got more to do, and it seemed like less time to do it, and you ain't able to do as much as you was when you were young. So they got three strikes against you, but it's always something. But sometimes we've got to lay those things to the side and be willing to do what needs to be done. The things that are most important, abounding in the work of the Lord. And so is that what your brethren see when they think about you? Or do they see the man in Luke 14, verse 18, when they were invited to the feast, it said, "And they all with one consent began to make excuse. The first said, 'I bought a piece of ground and I must eat, go and see it.' Well, that ground was going to be there tomorrow or the next week. Pray, have me excused. And another said, 'I bought 5 yoke of oxen and I go to prove them. I pray, have me excused.' Another said, 'I've married a wife and therefore I cannot come.'" And these were not reasons. They were nothing more than excuses. And you know, sometimes that's what, "Well, I'd love to come, but I've got to do this, or I've got to do this, or I really need to get this done, and I've been promising I'd do this." But we've got to weigh what's most important. But as brethren, again, a lot of things we could talk about, but we've got to skip right along to the next point. But what do people see? What do our brethren see? What do we see in each other? Something to consider. Then we might ask the question, "Well, what do you see when you look at yourself?" You know, we sometimes look in the mirror and try to find out if our hair is like it should be. I was going down to Bethel last Sunday night, I guess it was, and I went home and I like to tell my nieces and kids, I said, "There's something scary wrong with my house." Especially on Sunday afternoon, if I don't lay down on my couch, it'll just float up off the floor. So when I get home, I say, "I have to lay down and hold it to the floor." And, you know, I'm trying to tell them I like to take a nap on Sunday night, on Sunday afternoon. Anyway, I'm starting. I get here to Bethel, and I look up in the mirror, and not just to see somebody behind me, but I never had this left with my hair like this, you know, folded up. And I got here, and my hair is just standing up like this. What am I going to do? I brushed it for about 5 minutes. Never did lay down. I tried like a cat making it push it up, and I don't think I ever did get it to lay down. But you know, oftentimes that's the way we look in the mirror to see if our tie is straight or something about our dress or things like this. And the Bible tells us that we're to do that. In a spiritual sense also, James chapter 1, verses 23 and 24, said, "If any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, He's likened to a man beholding his natural face in a glass, for he beholds himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. Heard a lot of explanations about this, and there's a man named Mike Sobiak was preaching down at North, a little congregation there, and he said, you imagine, you remember how they used to have the TV commercial where you get a big glass of milk and you take a big drink and you got that milk mustache, and said, so you drink your breakfast or drink your milk on the way to breakfast, you start out the door and you look, and there's that old milk mustache, and then you walk right out the door. Don't even lock it off, don't even get a napkin, and there you are, you get to work, and you think how ridiculous that would be. If you look in the mirror and saw that, you know, at least you'd put your hand up there and wipe it off if you didn't have a paper towel or, you know, a napkin or something like that. Well, you know, that happens. We look into the gospel and we see what we are, we see what we need to be, and then we forget all about it. We hear it or we see it, but we don't act on it. Now, when we look, sometimes though, we're not completely honest with ourselves. We see what we want to see. You all probably remember the story of Saul when he was told to utterly destroy the Amalekites based on what had happened with the children of Israel trying to get to the promised land. The Amalekites not only attacked Israel, but it said they attacked from the back. Sneaky, you know, the women were the aged, the children, the sick, toward the back. They didn't attack the soldiers face to face. No, they attacked from rear. And God says, write down in the book, Moses, and we'll get them back. Well, Saul is going to be the one that's going to avenge it, and he's going to utterly destroy them, destroy everything about them. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 13, Samuel gets to where Saul is at, and Saul said unto him, blessed be thou of the Lord, I perform the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel more or less said, well, you have. Well, why do I, you know, hear the bleating of the sheep? Why do I hear the lowing of the cattle? What they gag doing standing there? And then Saul begins to make excuses about what others have done. But, you know, here Saul has said, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. He knew what the commandment was, and he said, I've done it. You know, I hope that we're not like that, that we fail to see, you know, what we need to do and when we think we've done it ourselves. So many times, you know, people in this world, and hopefully not members of the church, they'll have addictions and habits that are killing them, you know, and I can't see that they have a problem. Remember, a man came in the store, and he still trades with us today. He's about my height, but he's a lot stockier and younger and stronger than I am. He has served in Iraq, and one day we were there at the counter talking, and he said, my wife has got a problem with drugs. She's addicted to drugs. And he said, and I can't help her. He said, she denies that she has it. And this big, strong man, like that, had faced life and death over there, tears were just running down his face. He said, she denies it, and she won't. There's nothing I can do to help her. And he was just distraught. He didn't know what to do. You know, that's terrible in situations out in the world like this, but we have to look at our own lives and make sure that there's things that we don't deny and say, well, no, I don't have a drinking problem. I don't have a drug problem. I don't have a gambling problem. Whatever it is, we need to be willing to see it. And if we can see it, then we can do something about it. You know, we have to be able to see our faults.